A very warm welcome to all our Campus FM listeners today. This series is entitled Back in Time. In these episodes, we are discussing broad themes associated with the study of archaeology and trying to understand why these various fields are really significant in the exploration of the past. Before I introduce today's guests, I should mention that this program is being recorded on Zoom. So if you hear a few noises in the background, you'll know why. So helping us in our explorations today are Nathaniel Kutayar and Christian Mifsud, both of whom have worked extensively in archaeology and are currently curators at the National Museum of Archaeology within Heritage Malta. Christian today specializes in archaeology of historic buildings, while Nathaniel focuses on aspects of medieval and post-medieval archaeology. Welcome and thank you, Nathaniel and Chris, for accepting to come on the program to talk about marrying text with archaeology, artifacts and monuments, what that entails and the importance of such studies within the field of archaeology. So, on with my first query. I usually like to start with a bit of a definition. So a definition of how texts and artifacts relate to one another. Perhaps, Nathaniel, you'd like to start on that one.
Yes, hello. Today's program has been entitled Marrying Texts with Archaeology. In reality, this figurative marriage between the two disciplines is probably safe to say that if such a marriage could happen, it would be a very stormy marriage. Archaeology and history clearly share a lot of things in common, starting with the subject matter, which is events in the past, so the study of events in the past. Both disciplines aim at doing that. However, the methodology by which they pursue this, the subjective, is not similar. And the subject matter is also varied. So history tends to work with texts from the past and interpreting those texts. Archaeology tends to work with material culture in its various manifestations. So artifacts, stratigraphy, landscape. Naturally, texts are also a form of artifact, so there's an overlap possible there. However, the approach is extremely different, and so the conclusions, more often than not, will be different if taken according by the two different disciplines. This means that very often, history and archaeology, when studying the same issue relating to the past, can often not agree. I would argue it's actually healthier when they do not agree. I would actually argue that this tension, which is at the very bottom of the relationship, because it goes down to method, to the essential method of each discipline, this tension is actually a good thing. In the long run, living and learning to live and work with this internal tension produces new points of view and is a creative and enhances the creative process. Not overlooking these tensions and forcing the two narratives to match before too early in a stage results in a flat two-dimensional view of the past. And should be avoided. However, most people, including academics, both in history and in archaeology, have a problem living with this reality. Really, it is expected. So if I am studying the same set of events, I should be able to have a single point of view, a single understanding of those events. I would argue this is a naive expectation. The evidence behaves in a much more complex way and does not permit such an easy match. The problem is a very old one, starting with the rise of archaeology in the early 20th century and the even with Edwardian period archaeologists like Woolley, you often hear the trope, you know, that archaeology is the handmaiden of history. So archaeology illustrates what history has already established. This is frankly a patronizing definition in which archaeology is seen as a subservient, a servant, as a serving, a female serving figure to the master subject. But that came with the territory of the period, of course. The understanding, however, was less, what they understood by that metaphor was, of course, less, was more straightforward. What they thought was that archaeology could fill in the gaps left by the ancient historians. So if Herodotus gave us a list of pharaohs, and there was some gaps in that list of pharaohs, archaeology, Egyptology, through the archaeological remains, could actually fill in the gaps and build on that. So, but it's still, the underlying understanding is that it is subservient. You first have a historical account, and then archaeology comes in and fills in and does minor corrections. In other words, archaeology is not seen as having an independent voice. However, we do have, things have changed in reality, already starting with the philosophical work of authors like Collingwood, who was a British philosopher of history, and he was himself an archaeologist as well as an ancient historian. In the interwar period, followed more recently by work by Hodder, for example, who cites Collingwood and develops his idea of the contextual value of archaeology. So, these are all groundbreaking studies which demonstrated how the method of archaeology is in fact an independent one, but nonetheless one which is related and has to interact with history. So it is a historical subject, but with its own perspective. I personally strongly believe that today archaeologists should become a bit, and historians should be aware of this, should not treat this subject as a fringe subject. They should be aware of these issues, both the potentialities of working in a combined manner, but also the pitfalls, the methodological pitfalls, which are serious and manifold. We should learn to be, we should train ourselves intellectually to be conversant with the methods of archaeology, but also the methods and the limitations of history. This approach is most easy, most natural to apply in the archaeology of recent centuries. So what is sometimes described as post-medieval archaeology. That is because, speaking foremost at least, we have so much more archival material from 16th century onwards. And so the comparison between the two strands, the material evidence and the archival evidence is can be done more fully. For earlier periods, for the Middle Ages and less so for the ancient period, of course, the historical information becomes scantier and scantier as we go back in time. So the archaeology becomes more preponderant. However, for the recent centuries, for the last 500 years, so to speak, it is possible to develop very complex arguments based both on archives and on the material culture. Let's just remind ourselves, the entire city of Valletta, the entire Grand Harbor landscape is one big deposit of archaeology, of post-medieval archaeology, all the buildings, all the archaeology within the the archives, the art collections, that is all material culture which is open to archaeological interpretation. It's very interesting to train ourselves on the post-medieval period as archaeologists, to learn to use historical resources alongside the material ones, and then may hopefully look backwards and see if we can apply the same approaches to earlier periods.
Yeah, okay, that's very interesting. My goodness, that comparison was really, really illuminating. Chris, perhaps you could suggest some examples of how this approach can improve our understanding of historical buildings. I've recently attended a lecture of yours about the Auberge de Provence, and it all looked, you know, pretty complicated, much more complicated than I would ever have imagined, in fact.
Well, it is pretty complicated, especially when you consider that, for example, the historical approach to architecture in Malta is mostly based, it's traditionally based on the archival approach. So you go into the archives, get the data, and interpret the building. But that leads mostly to interpret the facades and the aesthetics of the building. You could sometimes get information like, for example, the date, construction dates. However, it's never a whole interpretation. You rarely get an interpretation from the start to the beginning. There are gaps in that. More recently, through the archaeology of buildings, we're seeing a new development. So the archaeology of building focuses not on the facades, on the aesthetics, but focuses on uses and function of the building. So technically, once you understand the building, you study the building for its phases, you study the building for its methods of construction, through a phenomenological approach, you literally try to contextualize yourself 400 years ago, how the building functioned, its spaces functioned, and together with the information from the archives, then a new interpretation can be obtained. So this is not, this promises to be a very interesting methodology, because you get to see both sides of the coin. However, it's never plain sailing as it seems. The final narrative tends to be very linear and quite interesting. However, getting to resolve issues between the archives and between the archaeology can be quite a hefty process to undertake. And most of the time, it's not a one-man job. You need a multidisciplinary approach, and discussion comes in. Unfortunately, I think locally we might be still stuck on some concepts we have about historic buildings. For example, we tend to see the buildings as very static, when in reality they are much more fluid. So, for example, looking at the auberges, you mentioned the Auberge de Provence. For a long time, we considered the Auberge de Provence as one complete building carried out at one go, when in fact now we're realizing there were multiple phases, and even the original project, for example, wasn't built in one stance. There were breaks in the construction, there were changes in the personnel, change in architects, even technology, the change in technology. So you tend to find incongruences, which then you have to resolve. As Nathaniel said, this is very practically simple for the early modern period. When you go even to earlier periods, for the medieval, for the Roman times, the lack of archival sources can be a problem to start and understand standing monuments and archaeological sites. Well, back to your question, therefore, I think the archaeologist's method for improving the understanding of the historical building is not only one which endorses, but rather one which whose curiosity can lead to constant questioning of what for some time has been deemed as an absolute. And that I think is very important.
The complexity of it is a joy, obviously, but it's so interesting but difficult to imagine these buildings in any other way. You know, you see the facade and it sticks in your mind. You think, oh, that's the building. But it is really interesting to see how one can find out so much more about the building at the end of the day. Nathaniel, is the same approach applicable in other areas of archaeology? We've heard that archaeology is different to the historical period. For example, does it work with archaeological ceramics, which are so important?
The short answer is that buildings are, of course, very far more complex artifacts to ceramics. Ceramics have a more limited biography. The production, the commerce, and their use and disposal will invariably are more short-lived than buildings are. So the internal history of the item is not so complex. However, ceramics are also by far the most common type of artifact recovered on archaeological excavation in any period and virtually in any region of the world. And is used by all strata of society, virtually. So it is a very powerful tool. And the collection of these ceramics from investigations constitutes an archive in its own right, not a paper archive, but a ceramic one. Reading and understanding and interpreting this archive, the ceramic archive, is, however, complex. And we have collectively, as archaeologists, only started tackling this subject. Traditionally, archaeology tends to look at ceramics in a very utilitarian way. In other words, you will find it said from the very beginnings of archaeology, from Petrie and Mortimer Wheeler, to this very day, ceramics are useful for the archaeologists because they have date sites or layers. So as a dating evidence. So not as an object with an intrinsic value, knowledge value, but as a stand-in for the dating. Especially for the history, but the same applies to some extent for the Middle Ages, say. Ceramics are used as a standby for cultures. So this is a tertiary period ceramic, so this is a Tartian culture or a Byzantine emperor, but now it's a Byzantine occupation. Both these readings are actually very problematic. Ceramics are a very poor resource to use for dating. If you have nothing better, then one has to use them and make the most of them. However, they give it's a very inadequate approach for a number of reasons, which is a bit complex to go into. Similarly, and it is less useful for the marking of cultures. Pottery is traded, it crosses cultural boundaries, the very notion of a cultural boundary is sort of suspect in many historical situations. So these are very inadequate way of approaching the value of ceramics. Ceramics have an internal, intrinsic type of knowledge which they can provide, which is best approached through a contextual approach. So as developed by others, part of the context of an of a ceramic. The word context has to be understood in a broad sense. Not only the technical context, the layer in which the object was found, and which is the ceramics were found, but even the building in which it was found, the location in the landscape, and even broader context, like the archival context. What information can we bring to bear from the archives relating directly or indirectly to the deposition to the manufacture, trade, and the position of these ceramics. When you approach it in this very broad and very sort of data-intensive way, very, very interesting readings can be done, which have very little to do with dating and very little to do with culture, and they become actual social readings. So an example of this is a study we have presented in a conference, Christian and myself, last year, which should be published very soon. It relates to a group of ceramics, for example, excavated in the 1960s, 1965. This was a group of Maiolica found during the demolition of the Auberge d'Auvergne, where the locals stand today. So the Auberge had been hit in the war, and rather than restoring it, it was decided to demolish it entirely. And in 65, they uncovered a pit cut in the rock, and which was full of ceramics. And a sample of these ceramics were kept at the museum at the time. There's a very short report, so an important and short report in the annual reports, but very brief and very with the basics information about the discovery. Again, back then they kept the ceramics because it is said literally it illustrates the culture of the period. So they're looking at them like a prehistorian, whatnot. So almost the material culture of the knights. But this is a partially preserved group of ceramics. So only the decorate Maiolica was kept in the 60s. Or at least only those were identified so far. The buildings in which they were found was demolished in 65, so the site is completely gone. We can't go and revisit the site. And we have only an outline description of the discovery. Nonetheless, by applying a very extensive use of archival research, including records from the Works Department, from the National Library, and from the Notarial Archives. So very wide-ranging approach to archival research. We have managed to reconstruct some very interesting aspects about the ownership of these objects. So starting with a reading of the objects themselves, we have moved on to investigate the class of people who would have owned these objects, and also the history of how these objects were moved over time. So how they started being collected around the 1630s, how the process of collection carries on into the 1700s, how they were put away in the end of the 1700s, and how they were thrown away in the early 19th century with the arrival of the British colonial administration. So we have managed to reconstruct a whole context to this discovery, creating a micro-history, but a very powerful one, of what society is like, or part of society in Valletta was like, from the 17th century into the 19th century. And this was possible by working on two levels, on the material culture and on the archival records. This would not have been possible for earlier periods. But what we can do is we can learn more about how deposits are created in this period and then try to re-study older deposits and see if the same rules apply. So that has a very interesting development to it.
Chris, perhaps now you could note sort of a bit the difference between sort of the interpretation of buildings and ceramics.
Buildings tend to be more complex than ceramics. Whilst the ceramic can be continually used in different phases, most of the time, in the case of ceramics, you're not going to find the adaptation. On the other hand, buildings are modified, so the actual evidence of modification is within the building itself. The interesting thing, however, archaeologists tend to look only to the survival evidence, when in reality, in a building, the modifications make away with some elements of the building. So the person studying these buildings has to be more flexible and look also to the elements which are not there. So most of the time, this even involves getting hands on the building, scraping the walls, doing the investigations. So this is not always possible. However, this can also provide a way how to think about stratigraphy. So in archaeology, we're used to go about stratigraphy in a certain way. Ground archaeology is very straightforward, where in the early years, or when we start studying, we get this case of the layers in a cake. In architecture, that can be much more complex, and it doesn't mean that what's on top is actually the latest layer. So new methods come in. Most of the time, we end up implementing methodological studies, documentation studies of the building, of the walls, and more importantly, we create relative chronologies. Relative chronologies are very important because they give you not only a temporal, but also a logical sequence of how things happened. Obviously, these are never finite, but can be actually tweaked and can be actually implemented with information from the data, from the ceramics, for example. Ceramics also provide data. While actually the building can actually give a bracket for a specific material. Also, in more recent years, with the democratization of the digital resources, new methodologies are actually allowing to understand buildings from a different approach. For example, with digital scanning or 3D reconstructions based on the building, on the archaeological evidence, now we can start understanding these complexities. These methodologies can be applied to ceramics. However, in the case of ceramics, they are more straightforward. It is always interesting then to see an interpretation based on both the ceramics and also the building, which gives you a whole new depth of interpretation, which sometimes we do lack. We tend to see the building mostly as a monument, when in reality the context, the narrative of the context still lacks. So together these two can actually bring a much more grounded and socially relevant interpretation.
Yeah, you mentioned the digital reconstructions. I've seen some recently, and they really, really do help to be able to see those very complex differences over time. We've really got the last minute. Perhaps, Nathaniel, you might sum up a little bit in two words the way forward.
Yes, in summation, what is amazing is that archaeologists should learn to be more conversant with the techniques and the resources of history. We should learn to work and converse with social historians, know more about archaeology. The future is the great breakthroughs, surely with many important breakthroughs in history, in historical studies, will probably depend on a multidisciplinary approach, including the contribution of archivists and other professionals, I should add. It's not limited to historians and archaeologists. So this is a plea to develop such an approach and to invest energy in that sense.
Thank you very much, Nathaniel Kutayar and Christian Mifsud, for being with us today and giving us such an interesting and a fascinating history, a story, an explanation of the relationship between buildings and artifacts and texts as well. Thank you so much. And I could just have time to say, I hope listeners will be with us next week. And this is Patricia Camilleri saying goodbye.